Books on Tape presents The English Patient by Michael Ondaatje, read by Christopher Cazenove. Most of you, I am sure, remember the tragic circumstances of the death of Geoffrey Clifton at Gilf Kebir, followed later by the disappearance of his wife, Catherine Clifton, which took place during the 1939 desert expedition in search of Zezura. I cannot begin this meeting tonight without referring very sympathetically to those tragic occurrences. The lecture this evening, from the minutes of the Geographical Society meeting of November 1940, London. Part 1. The Villa. She stands up in the garden where she has been working and looks into the distance. She has sensed a shift in the weather. There is another gust of wind, a buckle of noise in the air, and the tall cypresses sway. She turns and moves uphill towards the house, climbing over a low wall, feeling the first drops of rain on her bare arms. She crosses the loggia and quickly enters the house. In the kitchen she doesn't pause but goes through it and climbs the stairs which are in darkness, and then continues along the long hall, at the end of which is a wedge of light from an open door. She turns into the room, which is another garden, this one made up of trees and bowers painted over its walls and ceiling. The man lies on the bed, his body exposed to the breeze, and he turns his head slowly towards her as she enters. Every 4 days she washes his black body, beginning at the destroyed feet. She wets a washcloth, and holding it above his ankles, squeezes the water onto him, looking up as he murmurs, seeing his smile. Above the shins the burns are worst, beyond purple. Bone. She has nursed him for months, and she knows the body well, the penis sleeping like a seahorse, the thin, tight hips, hip bones of Christ, she thinks. He is her despairing saint. He lies flat on his back, no pillow, looking up at the foliage painted onto the ceiling, its canopy of branches, and above that, blue sky. She pours calamine in stripes across his chest, where he is less burned, where she can touch him. She loves the hollow below the lowest rib, its cliff of skin. Reaching his shoulders, she blows cool air onto his neck, and he mutters. "What?" she asks, coming out of her concentration. He turns his dark face with its grey eyes towards her. She puts her hand into her pocket. She unskins the plum with her teeth, withdraws the stone, and passes the flesh of the fruit into his mouth. He whispers again, dragging the listening heart of the young nurse beside him to wherever his mind is, into that well of memory he kept plunging into during those months before he died. There are stories the man recites quietly into the room which slip from level to level like a hawk. He wakes in the painted arbour that surrounds him with its spilling flowers, arms of great trees. He remembers picnics, a woman who kissed parts of his body that now are burned into the colour of aubergine. "I have spent weeks in the desert, forgetting to look at the moon," he says. "As a married man may spend days never looking into the face of his wife, these are not sins of omission, but signs of preoccupation." His eyes lock onto the young woman's face. If she moves her head, his stare will travel alongside her into the wall. She leans forward. "How are you burned?" It is late afternoon. His hands play with a piece of sheet, the back of his fingers caressing it.
"I fell burning into the desert. They found my body and made me a boat of sticks and dragged me across the desert. We were in the sand sea, now and then crossing dry riverbeds. Nomads, you see. Bedouin. I flew down and the sand itself caught fire. They saw me stand up naked out of it, the leather helmet on my head in flames. They strapped me onto a cradle, a carcass boat, and feet thudded along as they ran with me. I had broken the spareness of the desert. The Bedouin knew about fire. They knew about planes that since 1939 had been falling out of the sky. Some of their tools and utensils were made from the metal of crashed planes and tanks. It was the time of the war in heaven. They could recognize the drone of a wounded plane. They knew how to pick their way through such shipwrecks. A small bolt from a cockpit became jewelry. I was perhaps the first one to stand up alive out of a burning machine. A man whose head was on fire. They didn't know my name. I didn't know their tribe.
Who are you?
I don't know. You keep asking me.
You said you were English. At night, he is never tired enough to sleep. She reads to him from whatever book she is able to find in the library downstairs. The candle flickers over the page and over the young nurse's talking face, barely revealing at this hour the trees and vista that decorate the walls. He listens to her, swallowing her words like water. If it is cold, she moves carefully into the bed and lies beside him. She can place no weight upon him without giving him pain, not even her thin wrist. Sometimes at 2 a.m. he is not yet asleep, his eyes open in the darkness. He could smell the oasis before he saw it, the liquid in the air, the rustle of things, palms and bridles, the banging of tin cans whose deep pitch revealed they were full of water. They poured oil onto large pieces of soft cloth and placed them on him. He was anointed. He could sense the one silent man who always remained beside him, the flavor of his breath when he bent down to unwrap him every 24 hours at nightfall to examine his skin in the dark. Unclothed, he was once again the man naked beside the blazing aircraft. They spread the layers of gray felt over him. What great nation had found him, he wondered? What country invented such soft dates to be chewed by the man beside him and then passed from that mouth into his? During this time with these people, he could not remember where he was from. He could have been, for all he knew, the enemy he had been fighting from the air. Later, at the hospital in Pisa, he thought he saw beside him the face that had come each night and chewed and softened the dates and passed them down into his mouth. There was no color during those nights, no speech or song. The Bedouin silenced themselves when he was awake. He was on an altar of hammock, and he imagined in his vanity hundreds of them around him. And there may have been just two who had found him, plucked the antlered hat of fire from his head. Those two he knew only by the taste of saliva that entered him along with the date, or by the sound of their feet running. She would sit and read the book under the waver of light. She would glance, now and then, down the hall of the villa that had been a war hospital, where she had lived with the other nurses, before they'd all transferred out gradually, the war moving north, the war almost over. This was the time in her life that she fell upon books as the only door out of her cell. They became half her world. She sat at the night table, hunched over, reading of the young boy in India who learned to memorize diverse jewels and objects on a tray, tossed from teacher to teacher. Those who taught him dialect, those who taught him memory, those who taught him to escape the hypnotic. The book lay on her lap. She realized that for more than 5 minutes she had been looking at the porousness of the paper, the crease at the corner of page 17, which someone had folded over as a mark. She brushed her hand over its skin. A scurry in her mind, like a mouse in the ceiling, a moth on the night window. She looked down the hall, though there was no one else living there now, no one except the English patient and herself, in the Villa San Girolamo. She had enough vegetables planted in the bombed-out orchard above the house for them to survive. A man coming now and then from the town, with whom she would trade soap and sheets and whatever there was left in this war hospital for other essentials. Some beans, some meats. The man had left her 2 bottles of wine, and each night after she'd lain with the Englishman and he was asleep, she would ceremoniously pour herself a small beaker and carry it back to the night table just outside the 3/4 closed door, and sip away further into whatever book she was reading. So the books for the Englishman, as he listened intently or not, had gaps of plot, like sections of a road washed out by storms, missing incidents, as if locusts had consumed a section of tapestry, as if plaster loosened by the bombing had fallen away from a mural at night. The villa that she and the Englishman inhabited now was much like that. Some rooms could not be entered because of rubble. One bomb crater allowed moon and rain into the library downstairs, where there was, in one corner, a permanently soaked armchair. She was not concerned about the Englishman as far as the gaps in plot were concerned. She gave no summary of the missing chapters. She simply brought out the book and said, page 96, or page 111. That was the only locator. She lifted both of his hands to her face and smelled them, the odor of sickness still in them.
"Your hands are getting rough," he said.
"The weeds and thistles and digging."
"Be careful. I warned you about the dangers."
"I know." Then she began to read. Her father had taught her about hands, about a dog's paws. Whenever her father was alone with a dog in a house, he would lean over and smell the skin at the base of its paw. "This," he would say, as if coming away from a brandy snifter, "is the greatest smell in the world, a bouquet, great rumors of travel." She would pretend disgust, but the dog's paw was a wonder. The smell of it never suggested dirt. "It's a cathedral," her father had said. "So-and-so's garden, that field of grasses, a walk through cyclamen, a concentration of hints, of all the paths the animal had taken during the day. A scurry in the ceiling, like a mouse," and she looked up from the book again. They unwrapped the mask of herbs from his face. The day of the eclipse. They were waiting for it. Where was he? What civilization was this that understood the predictions of weather and light? El Ahmar or El Abiad? For they must be one of the northwest desert tribes. Those who could catch a man out of the sky, who covered his face with a mask of oasis reeds knitted together. He had now a bearing of grass. His favorite garden in the world had been the grass garden at Kew, the colors so delicate and various, like levels of ash on a hill. He gazed onto the landscape under the eclipse. They had taught him by now to raise his arms and drag strength into his body from the universe, the way the desert pulled down plains. He was carried on a palanquin of felt and branch. He saw the moving veins of flamingos across his sight in the half-darkness of the covered sun. Always there were ointments, or darkness, against his skin. One night he heard what seemed to be wind chimes high in the air, and after a while it stopped and he fell asleep with a hunger for it, that noise like the slowed-down sound from the throat of a bird, perhaps flamingo, or a desert fox, which one of the men kept in a sewn half-closed pocket in his burnous. The next day he heard snatches of the glassy sound as he lay once more covered in cloth, a noise out of the darkness. At twilight the felt was unwrapped, and he saw a man's head on a table moving towards him, then realized the man wore a giant yoke from which hung hundreds of small bottles on different lengths of string and wire. Moving as if part of a glass curtain, his body enveloped within that sphere. The figure resembled most of all those drawings of archangels he had tried to copy as a schoolboy, never solving how one body could have space for the muscles of such wings. The man moved with a long, slow gait, so smoothly there was hardly a tilt in the bottles. A wave of glass, an archangel, all the ointments within the bottles warmed from the sun, so when they were rubbed onto the skin they seemed to have been heated especially for a wound. Behind him was translated light, blues and other colors shivering in the haze and sand. The faint glass noise and the diverse colors and the regal walk and his face like a lean, dark gun. Up close the glass was rough and sandblasted, glass that had lost its civilization. Each bottle had a minute cork the man plucked out with his teeth and kept in his lips while mixing one bottle's contents with another's, a second cork also in his teeth. He stood over the supine burned body with his wings, sank two sticks deep into the sand, and then moved away, free of the 6-foot yoke, which balanced now within the crutches of the 2 sticks. He stepped out from under his shop. He sank to his knees and came towards the burned pilot and put his cold hands on his neck and held them there. He was known to everyone along the camel route from the Sudan north to Giza, the 40 days' road. He met the caravans, traded spice and liquid, and moved between oases and water camps. He walked through sandstorms with this coat of bottles, his ears plugged with 2 other small corks, so he seemed a vessel to himself, this merchant doctor, this king of oils and perfumes and panaceas, this Baptist. He would enter a camp and set up the curtain of bottles in front of whoever was sick. He crouched by the burned man. He made a skin cup with the soles of his feet and leaned back to pluck, without even looking, certain bottles. With the uncorking of each tiny bottle, the perfumes fell out. There was an odor of the sea, the smell of rust, indigo, ink, river mud, arrowwood, formaldehyde, paraffin, ether. The tide of airs chaotic. There were screams of camels in the distance as they picked up the scents. He began to rub green-black paste onto the ribcage. It was ground peacock bone, bartered for in a medina to the west or the south, the most potent healer of skin. Between the kitchen and the destroyed chapel, a door led into an oval-shaped library. The space inside seemed safe, except for a large hole at portrait level in the far wall caused by a mortar shell attack on the villa 2 months earlier. The rest of the room had adapted itself to this wound, accepting the habits of weather, evening stars, the sound of birds. There was a sofa, a piano covered in a grey sheet, the head of a stuffed bear, and high walls of books. The shelves nearest the torn wall bowed with the rain, which had doubled the weight of the books. Lightning came into the room too, again and again falling across the covered piano and carpet. At the far end were French doors that were boarded up. If they had been open, she could have walked from the library to the loggia, then down 36 penitent steps past the chapel towards what had been an ancient meadow, scarred now by phosphorus bombs and explosions. The German army had mined many of the houses they retreated from, so most rooms not needed, like this one, had been sealed for safety, the doors hammered into their frames. She knew these dangers when she slid into the room, walking into its afternoon darkness. She stood conscious suddenly of her weight on the wooden floor, thinking it was probably enough to trigger whatever mechanism was there. Her feet in dust. The only light poured through the jagged mortar circle that looked onto the sky. With a crack of separation, as if it were being dismantled from one single unit, she pulled out the last of the Mohicans, and even in this half-light was cheered by the aquamarine sky and lake on the cover illustration, the Indian in the foreground. And then, as if there was someone in the room who was not to be disturbed, she walked backwards, stepping on her own footprints, for safety, but also as part of a private game. So it would seem from the steps that she had entered the room, and then the corporeal body had disappeared. She closed the door and replaced the seal of warning. She sat in the window alcove in the English patient's room, the painted walls on one side of her, the valley on the other. She opened the book. The pages were joined together in a stiff wave. She felt like Crusoe, finding a drowned book that had washed up and dried itself on the shore. A narrative of 1757, illustrated by N.C. Wyeth. As in all of the best books, there was the important page with a list of illustrations, a line of text for each of them. She entered the story, knowing she would emerge from it, feeling she had been immersed in the lives of others, in plots that stretched back 20 years, her body full of sentences and moments, as if awaking from sleep with a heaviness caused by unremembered dreams. Their Italian hill town, sentinel to the northwest route, had been besieged for more than a month, the barrage focusing upon the 2 villas and the monastery surrounded by apple and plum orchards. There was the Villa Medici, where the generals lived. Just above it, the Villa San Girolamo, previously a nunnery whose castle-like battlements had made it the last stronghold of the German army. It had housed 100 troops, As the hill town began to be torn apart like a battleship at sea by fire shells, the troops moved from the barrack tents in the orchard into the now crowded bedrooms of the old nunnery. Sections of the chapel were blown up. Parts of the top story of the villa crumbled under explosions. When the Allies finally took over the building and made it a hospital, the steps leading to the third level were sealed off, though a section of chimney and roof survived. She and the Englishman had insisted on remaining behind when the other nurses and patients moved to a safer location in the south. During this time they were very cold, without electricity. Some rooms faced onto the valley with no walls at all. She would open a door and see just a sodden bed huddled against a corner, covered with leaves. Doors opened into landscape. Some rooms had become an open aviary. The staircase had lost its lower steps during the fire that was set before the soldiers left. She had gone into the library, removed 20 books, and nailed them to the floor, and then onto each other, in this way rebuilding the two lowest steps. Most of the chairs had been used for fires. The armchair in the library was left there because it was always wet, drenched by evening storms that came in through the mortar hole. Whatever was wet escaped burning during that April of 1945. There were few beds left. She herself preferred to be nomadic in the house with her pallet or hammock, sleeping sometimes in the English patient's room, sometimes in the hall, depending on temperature or wind or light. In the morning she rolled up her mattress and tied it into a wheel with string. Now it was warmer, and she was opening more rooms, airing the dark reaches, letting sunlight dry all the dampness. Some nights she opened doors and slept in rooms that had walls missing. She lay on the pallet on the very edge of the room, facing the drifting landscape of stars, moving clouds, wakened by the growl of thunder and lightning. She was 20 years old, and mad and unconcerned with safety during this time, having no qualms about the dangers of the possibly mined library or the thunder that startled her in the night. She was restless after the cold months when she had been limited to dark, protected spaces. She entered rooms that had been soiled by soldiers, rooms whose furniture had been burned within them. She cleared out leaves and shit and urine and charred tables. She was living like a vagrant, while elsewhere the English patient reposed in his bed like a king. From outside, the place seemed devastated. An outdoor staircase disappeared in mid-air, its railing hanging off. Their life was foraging and tentative safety. They used only essential candlelight at night because of the brigands who annihilated everything they came across. They were protected by the simple fact that the villa seemed a ruin. But she felt safe here, half adult and half child. Coming out of what had happened to her during the war, she drew her own few rules to herself. She would not be ordered again, or carry out duties for the greater good. She would care only for the burned patient. She would read to him and bathe him and give him his doses of morphine. Her only communication was with him. She worked in the garden and orchard. She carried the 6-foot crucifix from the bombed chapel and used it to build a scarecrow above her seedbed, hanging empty sardine cans from it, which clattered and clanked whenever the wind lifted. Within the villa she would step from rubble to a candle-lit alcove, where there was her neatly packed suitcase, which held little besides some letters, a few rolled-up clothes, a metal box of medical supplies. She had cleared just small sections of the villa, and all this she could burn down if she wished. She lights a match in the dark hall, and moves it onto the wick of the candle. Light lifts itself onto her shoulders. She is on her knees. She puts her hands on her thighs and breathes in the smell of sulphur. She imagines she also breathes in light. She moves backwards a few feet and with a piece of white chalk draws a rectangle onto the wood floor. Then continues backwards, drawing more rectangles, so there is a pyramid of them, single, then double, then single, her left hand braced flat on the floor, her head down, serious. She moves farther and farther away from the light, till she leans back onto her heels and sits crouching. She drops the chalk into the pocket of her dress. She stands and pulls up the looseness of her skirt and ties it around her waist. She pulls from another pocket a piece of metal and flings it out in front of her so it falls just beyond the farthest square. She leaps forward, her legs smashing down, her shadow behind her curling into the depth of the hall. She is very quick, her tennis shoes skidding on the numbers she has drawn into each rectangle, 1 foot landing, then 2 feet, then one again, until she reaches the last square. She bends down and picks up the piece of metal, pauses in that position, motionless, her skirt still tucked up above her thighs, hands hanging down loose, breathing hard. She takes a gulp of air and blows out the candle. Now she is in darkness. Just a smell of smoke. She leaps up, and in midair turns so she lands facing the other way, then skips forward even wilder now down the black hall, still landing on squares she knows are there, her tennis shoes banging and slamming onto the dark floor, so the sound echoes out into the far reaches of the deserted Italian villa, out towards the moon and the scar of a ravine that half circles the building. Sometimes at night the burned man hears a faint shudder in the building. He turns up his hearing aid to draw in a banging noise he still cannot interpret or place. She picks up the notebook that lies on the small table beside his bed. It is the book he brought with him through the fire, a copy of the Histories by Herodotus that he has added to, cutting and gluing in pages from other books or writing in his own observations, so they are cradled within the text of Herodotus. She begins to read his small, gnarled handwriting. There is a whirlwind in southern Morocco, the Ajej, against which the Fellaheen defend themselves with knives. There is the Africo, which has at times reached into the city of Rome. The Alm, a fall wind out of Yugoslavia. The Arifi, also christened Aref or Rifi, which scorches with numerous tongues. These are permanent winds that live in the present tense. There are other, less constant winds that change direction, that can knock down horse and rider and realign themselves anti-clockwise. The Bist Roz leaps into Afghanistan for 170 days, burying villages. There is the hot, dry Ghibli from Tunis, which rolls and rolls and produces a nervous condition. The Haboob, a Sudan dust storm that dresses in bright yellow walls 1,000 meters high and is followed by rain. The Harmattan, which blows and eventually drowns itself into the Atlantic. Imbat, a sea breeze in North Africa. Some winds that just sigh towards the sky. Night dust storms that come with the cold. The Khamsin, a dust in Egypt from March to May, named after the Arabic word for 50, blooming for 50 days. The ninth plague of Egypt. The Datu, out of Gibraltar, which carries fragrance. There is also the secret wind of the desert, whose name was erased by a king after his son died within it. And the Nafhat, a blast out of Arabia. The Metsa Ifulusun, a violent and cold southwesterly known to Berbers as that which plucks the fowls. The Peshaba, a black and dry northeasterly out of the Caucasus, black wind. The Samiel from Turkey, poison and wind, used often in battle, as well as the other poison winds, the Simoom of North Africa and the Solano, whose dust plucks off rare petals causing giddiness. Other private winds. Travelling along the ground like a flood, blasting off paint, throwing down telephone poles, transporting stones and statue heads. The Harmattan blows across the Sahara filled with red dust, dust as fire, as flour, entering and coagulating in the locks of rifles. Mariners call this red wind the Sea of Darkness. Red sand fogs out of the Sahara were deposited as far north as Cornwall and Devon, producing showers of mud so great this was also mistaken for blood. Blood rains were widely reported in Portugal and Spain in 1901. There are always millions of tons of dust in the air, just as there are millions of cubes of air in the earth, and more living flesh in the soil, worms, beetles, underground creatures, than there is grazing and existing on it. Herodotus records the death of various armies engulfed in the Simoom, who were never seen again. One nation was so enraged by this evil wind that they declared war on it and marched out in full battle array, only to be rapidly and completely interred. Dust storms in three shapes, the whirl, the column, the sheet. In the first, the horizon is lost. In the second, you are surrounded by waltzing jinns. The third, the sheet, is copper-tinted. Nature seems to be on fire. She looks up from the book and sees his eyes on her. He begins to talk across the darkness.
The Bedouin were keeping me alive for a reason. I was useful, you see. Someone there had assumed I had a skill when my plane crashed in the desert. I'm a man who can recognize an unnamed town by its skeletal shape on a map. I have always had information like a sea in me. I am a person who, if left alone in someone's home, walks to the bookcase, pulls down a volume, and inhales it. So history enters us. I knew maps of the seafloor, maps that depict weaknesses in the shield of the earth, charts painted on skin that contain the various routes of the Crusades. So I knew their place before I crashed among them. Knew when Alexander had traversed it at an earlier age, for this cause or that greed. I knew the customs of nomads besotted by silks or wells. One tribe dyed a whole valley floor, blackening it to increase convection, and thereby the possibility of rainfall, and built high structures to pierce the belly of a cloud. There were some tribes who held up their open palm against the beginnings of the wind, who believed that if this was done at the right moment, they could deflect a storm into an adjacent sphere of the desert, towards another, less loved tribe. There were continual drownings. Tribes suddenly made historical with sand across their grasp. In the desert, it is easy to lose a sense of demarcation. When I came out of the air and crashed into the desert, into those troughs of yellow, all I kept thinking was, I must build a raft. I must build a raft. And here, though I was in the dry sands, I knew I was among water people. In Tassili, I have seen rock engravings from a time when the Sahara people hunted water horses from reed boats. In Wadi Sura, I saw caves whose walls were covered with paintings of swimmers. Here, there had been a lake. I could draw its shape on a wall for them. I could lead them to its edge 6,000 years ago. Ask a mariner what is the oldest known sail, and he will describe a trapezoidal one hung from the mast of a reed boat that can be seen in rock drawings in Nubia, pre-dynastic. Harpoons are still found in the desert. These were water people. Even today, caravans look like a river. Still today it is water who is the stranger here. Water is the exile, carried back in cans and flasks, the ghost between your hands and your mouth. When I was lost among them, unsure of where I was, all I needed was the name of a small ridge, a local custom, a cell of this historical animal, and the map of the world would slide into place. What did most of us know of such parts of Africa? The armies of the Nile moved back and forth, the battlefield 800 miles deep into the desert. Whippet tanks, Blenheim medium-range bombers, gladiator biplane fighters, 8,000 men. But who was the enemy? Who were the allies of this place? The fertile lands of Cyrenaica, the salt marshes of El Agheila. All of Europe were fighting their wars in North Africa, in Sidi Rezegh, in Bagu.
He travelled on a skid behind the Bedouin for 5 days in darkness, the hood over his body. He lay within this oil-doused cloth. Then suddenly the temperature fell. They had reached the valley within the red high canyon walls, joining the rest of the desert's water tribe that spilled and slid over sand and stones, their blue robe shifting like a spray of milk or a wing. They lifted the soft cloth off him, off the suck of his body. He was within the larger womb of the canyon. The buzzards high above them slipping down 1,000 years into this crack of stone where they camped. In the morning they took him to the far reach of the Sikh. They were talking loudly around him now, the dialect suddenly clarifying. He was here because of the buried guns. He was carried towards something, his blindfolded face looking straight ahead, and his hand made to reach out a yard or so. After days of travel to move this 1 yard, to lean towards and touch something with a purpose, his arm still held, his palm facing down and open. He touched the Sten barrel, and the hand let go of him. A pause among the voices. He was there to translate the guns.
12mm Breda machine gun. From Italy.
He pulled back the bolt, inserted his finger to find no bullet, pushed it back and pulled the trigger. Putt.
Famous gun,
he muttered. He was moved forward again.
French 7.5mm Chatelero. Light machine gun. 1924. German 7.9mm MG-15 air service.
He was brought to each of the guns. The weapons seemed to be from different time periods and from many countries, a museum in the desert. He brushed the contours of the stock and magazine or fingered the sight. He spoke out the gun's name, then was carried to another gun. 8 weapons formally handed to him. He called the names out loud, speaking in French and then the tribe's own language. But what did that matter to them? Perhaps they needed not the name, but to know that he knew what the gun was. He was held by the wrist again, and his hand sunk into a box of cartridges. In another box to the right were more shells, 7mm shells this time, then others. When he was a child, he had grown up with an aunt, and on the grass of her lawn she had scattered a deck of cards face down and taught him the game of Pelmanism. Each player allowed to turn up 2 cards and eventually, through memory, pairing them off. This had been in another landscape of trout streams, bird calls he could recognize from a halting fragment, a fully named world. Now, with his face blindfolded in a mask of grass fibers, he picked up a shell and moved with his carriers, guiding them towards a gun, inserted the bullet, bolted it, and holding it up in the air, fired. The noise cracking crazily down the canyon walls. For echo is the soul of the voice, exciting itself in hollow places. A man thought to be sullen and mad had written that sentence down in an English hospital, and he, now in this desert, was sane, with clear thought, picking up the cards, bringing them together with ease, his grin flung out to his aunt, and firing each successful combination into the air, and gradually the unseen men around him replied to each rifle shot with a cheer. He would turn to face one direction, then move back to the breeder, this time on his strange human palanquin, followed by a man with a knife, who carved a parallel code on shell box and gun stock. He thrived on it, the movement and the cheering after the solitude. This was payment with his skill for the men who had saved him for such a purpose. There are villages he will travel into with them where there are no women. His knowledge is passed like a counter of usefulness from tribe to tribe, tribes representing 8,000 individuals. He enters specific customs and specific music. Mostly blindfolded, he hears the water-drawing songs of the Mazina tribe with their exaltations, dahia dances, pipe flutes which are used for carrying messages in times of emergency, the Makruna double pipe, one pipe constantly sounding a drone, then into the territory of 5-stringed lyres, a village or oasis of preludes and interludes, hand-clapping, antiphonal dance. He is given sight only after dusk, when he can witness his captors and saviours. Now he knows where he is. For some, he draws maps that go beyond their own boundaries, and for other tribes, too, he explains the mechanics of guns. The musicians sit across the fire from him. The Simsimia lyre notes flung away by a gust of breeze, or the notes shift towards him over the flames. There is a boy dancing, who in this light is the most desirable thing he has seen, his thin shoulders white as papyrus, light from the fire reflecting sweat on his stomach, nakedness glimpsed through openings in the blue linen he wears as a lure from neck to ankle, revealing himself as a line of brown lightning. The night desert surrounds them, traversed by a loose order of storms and caravans. There are always secrets and dangers around him, as when blind he moved his hand and cut himself on a double-edged razor in the sand. At times he doesn't know if these are dreams, the cut so clean it leaves no pain, and he must wipe the blood on his skull, his face still untouchable, to signal the wound to his captors. This village of no women he has been brought into in complete silence, or the whole month when he did not see the moon. Was this invented? dreamed by him while wrapped in oil and felt and darkness. They had passed wells where water was cursed. In some open spaces there were hidden towns, and he waited while they dug through sand into the buried rooms, or waited while they dug into nests of water. And the pure beauty of an innocent dancing boy, like sound from a boy chorister, which he remembered as the purest of sounds, the clearest river water, the most transparent depth of the sea. Here in the desert, which had been an old sea where nothing was strapped down or permanent, everything drifted, like the shift of linen across the boy, as if he were embracing or freeing himself from an ocean or his own blue afterbirth, a boy arousing himself, his genitals against the color of a fire. Then the fire is sanded over, its smoke withering around them, the fall of musical instruments like a pulse or rain. The boy puts his arm across, through the lost fire, to silence the pipe flutes. There is no boy. There are no footsteps when he leaves, just the borrowed rags. One of the men crawls forward and collects the semen which has fallen on the sand. He brings it over to the white translator of guns and passes it into his hands. In the desert, you celebrate nothing but water. She stands over the sink, gripping it, looking at the stucco wall. She has removed all mirrors and stacked them away in an empty room. She grips the sink and moves her head from side to side, releasing a movement of shadow. She wets her hands and combs water into her hair till it is completely wet. This cools her, and she likes it when she goes outside and the breezes hit her, erasing the thunder. Part 2. In Near Ruins. The man with bandaged hands had been in the military hospital in Rome for more than 4 months, when by accident he heard about the burned patient and the nurse, heard her name. He turned from the doorway and walked back into the clutch of doctors he had just passed to discover where she was. He had been recuperating there for a long time, and they knew him as an evasive man. But now he spoke to them, asking about the name, and startled them. During all that time he had never spoken, communicating by signals and grimaces, now and then a grin. He had revealed nothing, not even his name, just wrote out his serial number, which showed he was with the Allies. His status had been double-checked and confirmed in messages from London. There was the cluster of known scars on him. So the doctors had come back to him, nodded at the bandages on him. A celebrity, after all, wanting silence. A war hero. That was how he felt safest, revealing nothing. Whether they came at him with tenderness or subterfuge or knives. For more than 4 months he had not said a word. He was a large animal in their presence, in near ruins when he was brought in, and given regular doses of morphine for the pain in his hands. He would sit in an armchair in the darkness, watching the tide of movement among patients and nurses in and out of the wards and stockrooms. But now, walking past the group of doctors in the hall, he heard the woman's name, and he slowed his pace and turned and came up to them and asked specifically which hospital she was working in. They told him that it was in an old nunnery, taken over by the Germans, then converted into a hospital after the Allies had laid siege to it, in the hills north of Florence, most of it torn apart by bombing, unsafe. It had been just a temporary field hospital, but the nurse and the patient had refused to leave.
Why didn't you force the two of them down?
She claimed she was too ill to be moved. We could have brought him out safely, of course, but nowadays there's no time to argue. She was in rough shape herself.
Is she injured?
No, partial shell shock, probably. She should have been sent home. The trouble is, the war here is over. You cannot make anyone do anything anymore. Patients are walking out of hospitals. Troops are going AWOL before they get sent back home.
Which villa? He asked.
It's one they say has a ghost in the garden, San Girolamo. Well, she's got her own ghost, a burned patient. There is a face, but it is unrecognizable. The nerves all gone. You can pass a match across his face and there's no expression. The face is asleep.
Who is he? He asked.
We don't know his name.
He won't talk?
The clutch of doctors laughed. No, he talks. He talks all the time. He just doesn't know who he is.
Where did he come from?
The Bedouin brought him into Siwa Oasis. Then he was in Pisa for a while, then... One of the Arabs is probably wearing his name tag. He'll probably sell it, and we'll get it one day, or perhaps they will never sell it. These are great charms. All pilots who fall into the desert, none of them come back with identification. Now he's holed up in a Tuscan villa and the girl won't leave him, simply refuses. The Allies housed 100 patients there. Before that, the Germans held it with a small army, their last stronghold. Some rooms are painted, each room has a different season. Outside the villa is a gorge. All this is about 20 miles from Florence in the hills. You'll need a pass, of course. We can probably get someone to drive you up. It's still terrible out there. Dead cattle, horses shot dead, half-eaten, people hanging upside down from bridges. The last vices of war. Completely unsafe. The sappers haven't gone in there yet to clear it. The Germans retreated, burying and installing mines as they went. Terrible place for a hospital. The smell of the dead is the worst. We need a good snowfall to clean up this country. We need ravens. Thank you.
He walked out of the hospital into the sun, into open air for the first time in months, out of the green-lit rooms that lay like glass in his mind. He stood there, breathing everything in, the hurry of everyone.
First, he thought, I need shoes with rubber on the bottom. I need gelato.
He found it difficult to fall asleep on the train, shaking from side to side. The others in the compartment smoking, his temple banging against the window frame. Everyone was in dark clothes and the carriage seemed to be on fire with all the lit cigarettes. He noticed that whenever the train passed a cemetery, the travellers around him crossed themselves.
She's in rough shape herself.
Gelato for tonsils, he remembered. Accompanying a girl and her father to have her tonsils out. She had taken one look at the ward full of other children and simply refused. This, the most adaptable and genial of children, suddenly turned into a stone of refusal, adamant. No one was ripping anything out of her throat, though the wisdom of the day advised it. She would live with it in, whatever it looked like. He still had no idea what a tonsil was. They never touched my head, he thought. That was strange. The worst times were when he began to imagine what they would have done next. Cut next. At those times he always thought of his head. A scurry in the ceiling, like a mouse. He stood with his valise at the far end of the hall. He put the bag down and waved across the darkness and the intermittent pools of candlelight. There was no clatter of footsteps as he walked towards her, not a sound on the floor. And that surprised her, was somehow familiar and comforting to her. That he could approach this privacy of hers and the English patients without loudness. As he passed the lamps in the long hall, they flung his shadow forward ahead of him. She turned up the wick on the oil lamp, so it enlarged the diameter of light around her. She sat very still, the book on her lap, as he came up to her, and then crouched beside her, like an uncle.
Tell me what a tonsil is.
Her eyes staring at him.
I keep remembering how you stormed out of the hospital, followed by 2 grown men.
She nodded.
Is your patient in there? Can I go in?
She shook her head, kept shaking it until he spoke again.
I'll see him tomorrow, then. Just tell me where to go. I don't need sheets. Is there a kitchen? Such a strange journey I took in order to find you.
When he had gone along the hall, she came back to the table and sat down, trembling. Needing this table, this half-finished book, in order to collect herself. A man she knew had come all the way by train, and walked the 4 miles uphill from the village and along the hall to this table just to see her. After a few minutes she walked into the Englishman's room and stood there looking down on him, moonlight across the foliage on the walls. This was the only light that made the trondoy seem convincing. She could pluck that flower and pin it onto her dress. The man named Caravaggio pushes open all the windows in the room so he can hear the noises of the night. He undresses, rubs his palms gently over his neck, and for a while lies down on the unmade bed. The noise of the trees, the breaking of moon into silver fish bouncing off the leaves of asters outside. The moon is on him like skin, a sheaf of water. An hour later he is on the roof of the villa.
Up on the peak he is aware of the shelled sections along the slope of roofs, the 2 acres of destroyed gardens and orchards that neighbour the villa. He looks over where they are in Italy. In the morning, by the fountain, they talk tentatively.
Now you're in Italy, you should find out more about Verdi.
What? She looks up from the bedding she is washing out in the fountain. He reminds her,
You told me once you were in love with him.
Hannah bows her head, embarrassed. Caravaggio walks around, looking at the building for the first time, peering down from the loggia into the garden.
Yes, you used to love him. He used to drive us all mad with your new information about Giuseppe. What a man! The best in every way, you'd say. We all had to agree with you, the cocky 16-year-old.
I wonder what happened to her. She spreads the wash sheet over the rim of the fountain.
You are someone with a dangerous will.
She walks over the paved stones, grass in the cracks. He watches her black stockinged feet, the thin brown dress. She leans over the balustrade. I think I did come here. I have to admit, something at the back of my mind made me for Verdi. And then, of course, you had left, and my dad had left for the war. Look at the hawks. They're here every morning. Everything else is damaged and in pieces here. The only running water in this whole villa is in this fountain. The Allies dismantled water pipes when they left. They thought that would make me leave.
You should have. They still have to clear this region. There are unexploded bombs all over the place.
She comes up to him and puts her fingers on his mouth. I'm glad to see you, Caravaggio. No one else. Don't say you have come here to try and persuade me to leave.
I want to find a small bar with a Wurlitzer and drink without a fucking bomb going off. Listen to Frank Sinatra singing. We have to get some music, he says. Good for your patient.
He's still in Africa. He is watching her, waiting for her to say more, but there is nothing more about the English patient to be said. He mutters,
Some of the English love Africa. A part of their brain reflects the desert precisely, so they're not foreigners there.
He sees her head nod slightly. A lean face with hair cut short without the mask and mystery of her long hair. If anything, she seems calm in this universe of hers. The fountain gurgling in the background, the hawks, the ruined garden of the villa. Maybe this is the way to come out of the war, he thinks. A burned man to care for, some sheets to wash in a fountain, a room painted like a garden. As if all that remains is a capsule from the past, long before Verdi, the Medici's considering a balustrade or window, holding up a candle at night in the presence of an invited architect, the best architect in the 15th century, and requesting something more satisfying to frame that vista. If you're staying, she says, we're going to need more food. I have planted vegetables, we have a sack of beans, but we need some chickens. She is looking at Caravaggio, knowing his skills from the past, not quite saying it.
I lost my nerve, he says.
I'll come with you then, Hannah offers. We'll do it together. You can teach me to steal. Show me what to do.
You don't understand. I've lost my nerve.
Why?
I was caught. They nearly chopped off my fucking hands.
At night sometimes, when the English patient is asleep, or even after she has read alone outside his door for a while, she goes looking for Caravaggio. He will be in the garden, lying along the stone rim of the fountain, looking up at stars, or she will come across him on a lower terrace. In this early summer weather, he finds it difficult to stay indoors at night. Most of the time he is on the roof beside the broken chimney, but he slips down silently when he sees her figure cross the terrace looking for him. She will find him near the headless statue of a count, upon whose stub of neck one of the local cats likes to sit, solemn and drooling when humans appear. She is always made to feel that she is the one who has found him, this man who knows darkness, who when drunk used to claim he was brought up by a family of owls. 2 of them on a promontory, Florence and her lights in the distance. Sometimes he seems frantic to her, or he will be too calm. In daylight she notices better how he moves, notices the stiffened arms above the bandaged hands, how his whole body turns instead of just the neck when she points to something farther up the hill. But she has said nothing about these things to him. My patient thinks peacock bone ground up is a great healer. He looks up into the night sky. Yeah. Were you a spy then? Not quite. He feels more comfortable, more disguised from her in the dark garden, a flicker of the lamp from the patient's room looking down.
At times we were sent in to steal. Here I was, an Italian, a thief. They couldn't believe their luck. They were falling over themselves to use me. There were about four or five of us. I did well for some time. Then I was accidentally photographed. Can you imagine that? I was in a tuxedo, a monkey suit, in order to get into this gathering, a party, to steal some papers. Really, I was still a thief, no great patriot, no great hero. They had just made my skills official. But one of the women had brought a camera and was snapping at the German officers, and I was caught in mid-step walking across the ballroom. In mid-step, the beginning of the shutter's noise making me jerk my head towards it. So suddenly everything in the future was dangerous. Some general's girlfriend. All photographs taken during the war were processed officially in government labs, checked by the Gestapo. So there I would be, obviously not part of any list, to be filed away by an official when the film went to the Milan laboratory. So it meant having to try and steal that film back somehow.
She looks in on the English patient, whose sleeping body is probably miles away in the desert, being healed by a man who continues to dip his finger into the bowl made with the joined soles of his feet, leaning forward, pressing the dark paste against the burned face. She imagines the weight of the hand on her own cheek. She walks down the hall and climbs into her hammock, giving it a swing as she leaves the ground. Moments before sleep are when she feels most alive, leaping across fragments of the day, bringing each moment into the bed with her like a child with schoolbooks and pencils. The day seems to have no order until these times, which are like a ledger for her, a body full of stories and situations. Caravaggio has, for instance, given her something. His motive, a drama and a stolen image. He leaves the party in a car. It crunches over the slowly curving gravel path leading out of the grounds, the automobile purring, serene as ink within the summer night. For the rest of the evening, during the Villa Cosima gathering, he had been looking at the photographer, spinning his body away whenever she lifted the camera to photograph in his direction. Now that he knows of its existence, he can avoid it. He moves into the range of her dialogue. Her name is Anna, mistress to an officer, who will be staying here in the villa for the night, and then in the morning will travel north through Tuscany. The death of the woman or the woman's sudden disappearance will only arouse suspicion. Nowadays, anything out of the ordinary is investigated. 4 hours later, he runs over the grass in his socks, his shadow curled under him, painted by the moon. He stops at the gravel path and moves slowly over the grit. He looks up at the Villa Cosima, at the square moons of window, a palace of war women. A car beam, like something sprayed out of a hose, lights up the room he is in, and he pauses once again in mid-step, seeing that same woman's eyes on him, a man moving on top of her, his fingers in her blonde hair. And she has seen, he knows, even though now he is naked, the same man she photographed earlier in the crowded party, for by accident he stands the same way now, half turned in surprise at the light that reveals his body in the darkness. The car lights sweep up into a corner of the room and disappear. Then there is blackness. He doesn't know whether to move, whether she will whisper to the man fucking her about the other person in the room, a naked thief, a naked assassin. Should he move, his hands out to break a neck, towards the couple on the bed? He hears the man's lovemaking continue, hears the silence of the woman, no whisper, hears her thinking, her eyes aimed towards him in the darkness. The word should be thinkering. Caravaggio's mind slips into this consideration, another syllable to suggest collecting a thought as one tinkers with a half-completed bicycle. Words are tricky things, a friend of his has told him. They're much more tricky than violins. His mind recalls a woman's blonde hair, the black ribbon in it. He hears the car turning and waits for another moment of light. The face that emerges out of the dark is still an arrow upon him. The light moves from her face, down onto the body of the general, over the carpet, and then touches and slides over Caravaggio once more. He can no longer see her. He shakes his head, then mimes the cutting of his throat. The camera is in his hands for her to understand. Then he is in darkness again. He hears a moan of pleasure now from her towards her lover, and he is aware it is her agreement with him. No words, no hint of irony, just a contract with him, the morse of understanding. So he knows he can now move safely to the veranda and drop out into the night. Finding her room had been more difficult. He had entered the villa and silently passed the half-lit 17th-century murals along the corridors. Somewhere there were bedrooms like dark pockets in a gold suit. The only way he could get past the guards was to be revealed as an innocent. He had stripped completely and left his clothes in a flower bed. He ambles naked up the stairs to the second floor, where the guards are, bending down to laugh at some privacy so his face is almost at his hip, nudging the guards about his evening's invitation, al fresco, was that it? Or seduction, a cappella. One long hall on the third floor, a guard by the stair, and one at the far end, 20 yards away, too many yards away. So, a long, theatrical walk, and Caravaggio now having to perform it, watched with quiet suspicion and scornfully by the two bookended sentries. The arse and cock walk, pausing at a section of mural to peer at a painted donkey in a grove. He leans his head on the wall, almost falling asleep, then walks again, stumbles, and immediately pulls himself together into a military gait. His stray left hand waves to the ceiling of cherubs, bum-naked as he is, a salute from a thief, a brief waltz, while the mural scene drifts haphazardly past him, castles, black-and-white duomos, uplifted saints on this Tuesday during the war, in order to save his disguise and his life. Caravaggio is out on the tiles, looking for a photograph of himself. He pats his bare chest as if looking for his pass, grabs his penis, and pretends to use it as a key to let him into the room that is being guarded. Laughing, he staggers back, peeved at his woeful failure, and slips into the next room, humming. He opens the window and steps out onto the veranda, a dark, beautiful night. Then he climbs off it and swings onto the veranda, one level below. Only now can he enter the room of Anna and her general. Nothing more than a perfume in their midst, printless foot, shadowless. The story he told someone's child years ago about the person who searched for his shadow, as he is now looking for this image of himself on a piece of film. In the room he is immediately aware of the beginnings of sexual movement, his hands within her clothing thrown onto the chair backs, dropped upon the floor. He lies down and rolls across the carpet in order to feel anything hard like a camera, touching the skin of the room. He rolls in silence in the shape of fans, finding nothing. There is not even a grain of light. He gets to his feet and sways his arms out slowly, touches a breast of marble. His hand moves along a stone hand. He understands the way the woman thinks now, off which the camera hangs with its sling. Then he hears the vehicle, and simultaneously as he turns is seen by the woman in a sudden spray of carlight. Caravaggio watches Hannah, who sits across from him looking into his eyes, trying to read him, trying to figure the flow of thought the way his wife used to do. He watches her sniffing him out, searching for the trace. He buries it and looks back at her, knowing his eyes are faultless, clear as any river, unimpeachable as a landscape. People he knows get lost in them, and he is able to hide well. But the girl watches him quizzically, tilting her head in a question, as a dog would when spoken to in a tone or pitch that is not human. She sits across from him in front of the dark, blood-red walls, whose colour he doesn't like, and in her black hair, and with that look, slim, tanned olive from all the light in this country, she reminds him of his wife. Nowadays he doesn't think of his wife, though he knows he can turn around and evoke every move of her, describe any aspect of her, the weight of her wrist on his heart during the night. He sits with his hands below the table, watching the girl eat. He still prefers to eat alone, though he always sits with Hannah during meals. Vanity, he thinks. Mortal vanity. She has seen him from a window, eating with his hands as he sits on one of the 36 steps by the chapel, not a fork or knife in sight, as if he were learning to eat like someone from the East. In his graying stubble beard, in his dark jacket, she sees the Italian finally in him. She notices this more and more. He watches her darkness against the brown and red walls, her skin, her cropped dark hair. He had known her and her father in Toronto before the war. Then he had been a thief, a married man, slipped through his chosen world with a lazy confidence, brilliant in deceit against the rich, or charm towards his wife, Gianetta, or with this young daughter of his friend. But now there is hardly a world around them, and they are forced back on themselves. During these days in the hill town near Florence, indoors during the days of rain, daydreaming in the one soft chair in the kitchen, or on the bed, or on the roof, he has no plots to set in motion, is interested only in Hannah. And it seems she has chained herself to the dying man upstairs. During meals, he sits opposite this girl and watches her eat. Half a year earlier, from a window at the end of the long hall in Santa Chiara Hospital in Pisa, Hannah had been able to see a white lion. It stood alone on top of the battlements, linked by colour to the white marble of the Duomo and the Camposanto, though its roughness and naive form seemed part of another era, like some gift from the past that had to be accepted. Yet she accepted it most of all among the things surrounding this hospital. At midnight she would look through the window and know it stood within the curfew blackout, and that it would emerge, like her, into the dawn shift. She would look up at 5 or 5:30, and then at 6 to see its silhouette and growing detail. Every night it was her sentinel while she moved among patients. Even through the shelling, the army had left it there, much more concerned about the rest of the fabulous compound, with its mad logic of a tower leaning like a person in shell shock. Their hospital buildings lay in old monastery grounds. The topiary, carved for thousands of years by careful monks, was no longer bound within recognizable animal forms, and during the day nurses wheeled patients among the lost shapes. It seemed that only white stone remained permanent. Nurses, too, became shell-shocked from the dying around them, or from something as small as a letter. They would carry a severed arm down a hall, or swab at blood that never stopped, as if the wound were a well, and they began to believe in nothing, trusted nothing. They broke the way a man dismantling a mine broke the second his geography exploded, the way Hannah broke in Santa Chiara Hospital when an official walked down the space between 100 beds and gave her a letter that told her of the death of her father, a white lion. It was sometime after this that she had come across the English patient, someone who looked like a burned animal, taut and dark, a pool for her. And now, months later, he is her last patient in the Villa San Girolamo, their war over, both of them refusing to return with the others to the safety of the Pisa hospitals. All the coastal ports, such as Sorrento and Marina di Pisa, are now filled with North American and British troops waiting to be sent home. But she washed her uniform, folded it, and returned it to the departing nurses. The war is not over everywhere, she was told. The war is over. This war is over. The war here. She was told it would be like desertion. This is not desertion. I will stay here. She was warned of the uncleared mines, lack of water and food. She came upstairs to the burned man, the English patient, and told him she would stay as well. He said nothing, unable even to turn his head towards her, but his fingers slipped into her white hand, and when she bent forward to him, he put his dark fingers into her hair and felt it cool within the valley of his fingers.
How old are you?
20.
There was a duke, he said, who when he was dying wanted to be carried halfway up the tower in Pisa so he could die looking out into the middle distance.
A friend of my father's wanted to die while Shanghai dancing. I don't know what it is. He had just heard of it himself.
What does your father do?
He is in the war.
You're in the war, too?
She does not know anything about him, even after a month or so of caring for him and allotting him the needles of morphine. There was shyness at first within both of them, made more evident by the fact that they were now alone. Then it was suddenly overcome. The patients and doctors and nurses and equipment and sheets and towels all went back down the hill into Florence and then to Pisa. She had salted away codeine tablets as well as the morphine. She watched the departures, the line of trucks. Goodbye, then. She waved from his window, bringing the shutters to a close.